This program is released under a Creative Commons license. For more information, visit creativecommons.org. This is Christ the Center, episode 31. Today we speak with Jeff Jew about the eschatological views of the Westminster Divines. Welcome to Christ the Center, Doctrine for Life, our weekly conversation of Reformed theology. My name is Camden Busey, and I have a very special group with me today. We're actually all present around the same table. We have Jeff Waddington, who's teacher of the congregation at Presbyterian Church in Ringo's, New Jersey. Nick Batzig, who's interim pastor at Christ the King PCA in Conshohocken, Pennsylvania. Dr. Lane Tipton, who is an associate professor at Westminster Theological Seminary in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and also our special guest today, our subject of attention is Dr. Jeff Jew, who is also associate professor of church history at Westminster Theological Seminary. Good evening, guys. We've been going for a while. We're excited about actually getting into our subject today, to be speaking about the eschatological views of the Westminster Divines, a very interesting historical topic, and we'll get to that in a moment. But of course, we need to pause for our special discussion of any new publications. Jeff, have you mentioned or seen anything new?
Well, just today in the mail, I did receive a new little book by Al Mohler.
Yeah.
Entitled Atheism Remix, which is a answer to the new atheism.
Of Christopher Hitchens, Daniel Dennett, is that right?
Dawkins,
that's right.
All of that.
Sam.
It's a crossway title.
Harris, yes.
And let's see, I've been inundated with so many books, I'm trying to think. Nothing comes to mind. Nick?
I have nothing.
Have you guys been reading anything else? Man, we're just stumped. Okay.
Oh, I did remember. Randall Zachman has a new book called John Calvin and Roman Catholicism. Mm. That's just come out from Baker.
Okay.
Books.
I got to say that I did, we mentioned it already, I believe, The Certainty of the Faith by Richard Ramsey is a book that I gave a brief review on the website. I really enjoyed that. It was maybe a little bit broadly presuppositional, not a bad thing, but for those hardcore staunch Fantilians out there, maybe a little bit too broad, but I thought it was a great book and I think really can work in even a hardcore Fantilian scheme. And the difference that this book makes, and the reason why I think people should read it, especially college students and lay people, is it provides a very practical introduction to how to actually do the presuppositional method of apologetics. When you read Van Til, sometimes you're left with, okay, that's great theory, that's great method, great theology. How do I actually do this with my neighbor? This book I found was very helpful in doing that in an accessible way. Also provided a really brief overview of the history of Western philosophy and also some key figures in Christian apologetics, which are helpful in just giving a lay of the land. So it's a good book, The Certainty of the Faith by Richard Ramsey. Anything else? What have you been reading, Lane or Jeff?
A couple of books now worth looking at that I think might be of interest. The first is The Surprising Work of God. It is a book by Garth Rozelle up at Gordon-Conwell Theological Seminary on the life of Harold Ockingham and Billy Graham, the influence of them on 20th century evangelicalism. Good historical piece, really gives you some insight into Ockingham and the developments in that period. The other one I would say that might be worth picking up is D.A. Carson's Christ and Culture.
Yes.
Fascinating, I would say, because he is attempting to bring biblical theological categories to bear upon issues of Christ and culture. Now, you know, I appreciate a lot of what he has to say there. Certain things, of course, I would like him to explore more deeply. But overall, I think it's worth a good read.
Excellent. We have mentioned that before. Haven't gone into detail on that one, but that's definitely something you should pick up and read.
Both of those books we've mentioned, but we haven't gotten around to reading them yet. But that's good advice.
Excellent.
Look into that.
Were there any other books or conferences or things that ought to be mentioned before we move on to our main topic of discussion?
You mean besides the 10 or 12 or 15 books that we're all working on?
Yeah, exactly. We've been reading so much.
Maybe I should mention one more academic.
Yeah, please.
It's a little more academic book.
That's what we're after, yeah, actually.
It might be worth reading for all those Puritan history buffs out
yeah.
there. Susan Hardman Moore's latest book on pilgrims, title is Pilgrims, The Call Home. It's an interesting look at those who migrated to New England and back to England. And the interesting issues, topics, things that influence them to consider re-immigration. I don't know if that's the best term to describe it, of moving back in the 17th century from New England back to Old England. Yeah. Worth taking a look at, too, of those who are interested in more kind of his more academic historical book on Puritans.
Were there any effects on ecclesiology or any other aspects of theology that are peculiar to people that had been in America for a while?
Yeah, it'll be interesting if you take a look at her book, especially in terms of the impact of Congregationalism as these ministers migrate back to the old world and deal with the settlements both within the interregnum period and the restoration period. Worth taking a look at.
Cool.
And since we're talking about historical works, Matthew Poole's Synopsis of Scripture, I forget the Latin title, I'm not sure the English, but I know that most of those volumes have been translated from Latin to English, and that would be a valuable work because basically Poole went through all the divines on portions of Scripture, everything that he had available, and that has not been in English for 400 years, so that's out now. I think most of the set's complete. We could find out a publisher for those that are listening to us on the web.
Sure. It's a Stephen Dilday, isn't it? The translator.
Excellent. We'll definitely put those in our bibliography.
A favorite commentator for Jonathan Edwards.
Yes.
Synopsis Criticorum. Mm-hmm. I forget the rest of the Latin.
Well, if that's all, we would like to move on to our main discussion on the eschatological views of the Westminster Divines. This is actually a very interesting historical question. What were the views of the Westminster Divines? And I believe the thesis that we're going to arrive at today is actually going to be very surprising to our listeners. Dr. Jeff Jew, you have done doctoral work in this area. That's my understanding. Will you give us just if we want to put it this way, the view that people would expect from the divines and then the view in broad strokes of what you've actually found to be of many of the divines.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me begin by saying I think that there is a lot of historical assumptions out there about what the divines held to in terms of their eschatological views. Now, in the secondary sources, I've read everything from them being staunch postmillennialists, to use our more modern terms, to amillennialists, to some saying no, but there was a tolerance for premillennialists. And so basically you've got people saying that pretty much everything under the sun could fit into different interpretations of what the divines had said. Before going into their specific eschatological views, I think it might be helpful to paint a bit of a historical survey that will kind of set the stage for what the divines were wrestling with when we get to this topic of eschatology in the 17th century. Mm-hmm. So if I could do that for
Please.
A couple minutes, I think that will be helpful for us. Let me begin in the anti-Nicene period and the rise of the Kiliastic church fathers, people like Irenaeus, Justin Martyr, Lactantius, who were clearly Kiliastic. Now, Kiliism from the Greek 1000, in which they argued for what we would describe probably as a kind of generic premillennialism, in which they believed that Revelation 20 was actually teaching about a future 1,000-year terrestrial reign of Christ on earth. It's a future millennium. Mm-hmm. And people have asked the question, well, you know, why did this position emerge in that period of time? And I think that if I could point our listeners to Charles Hill's work down at RTS Orlando, who in his doctoral dissertation that I believe was published, Regnum Caelorum, that discusses early church eschatology, in which he argues that there were a number of factors kind of pushing the early church fathers toward this position of Kiliasm. And he points out particularly the Gnosticism that was emerging at the time. Of course, Gnosticism, which was a denial in general sense, I'm speaking very broadly, of that which is physical, of that which is material. And what better way as an apologetic to confront Gnosticism in affirming the bodily resurrection, but not just the bodily resurrection, but also the kingdom of Christ in a millennial period as being terrestrial, as being physical. And that, no, the physical isn't bad. It's not something that we're supposed to transcend, as some of the Gnostics were teaching, but as something that would actually be incorporated into the very kingdom that Christ was going to bring in the future. And you see that quite a bit in some of these early church fathers. Alongside of that, also, you see the adoption of what many consider to be a Jewish eschatology that anticipated a messianic kingdom that would also be an earthly terrestrial kingdom, and that being incorporated into the early church as well. But it's interesting to see that by the time of Augustine, in which Kiliasm and Gnosticism both kind of die out, Augustine, who admits that he was a Kiliast at first, but begins to reinterpret, particularly Revelation 20, and begins to move to a much more what we would probably describe as a spiritual or symbolic interpretation, in which he's describing then the vision of John in Revelation 20 as describing the entire church age. And Augustine, great theologian that he was, becomes the dominant position throughout the medieval period. No surprise, much of his theology had huge impact throughout the medieval church. And it's really throughout that period that Kiliasm is dead and that Augustine's symbolic interpretation from the city of God is the dominant position. Now, what would that position be? Well, some postmillennialists will say, well, Augustine was a kind of proto-postmillennialist. All millennialists would argue the same thing. I would rather, instead of kind of being anachronistic and imposing our present systematic categories on Augustine, simply say he was a spiritual symbolic interpreter of the book of Revelation and did not want to match one-to-one correspondence in terms of prophetic fulfillment through the visions that you see in Revelation. Now, it's fascinating to see that in the 16th century, something unique happens in terms of interpretation of these prophetic and apocalyptic biblical texts. Something amazing happened, and of course this can be traced right down to our great first reformer, Martin Luther. Luther, in the first edition of his translation of the Bible into German, and he goes through and he has little prefaces to each of the books. And the first one, in the first edition, I can't remember the exact date of it, but the first edition for the book of Revelation, Luther describes it as unhelpful, doesn't preach Christ. And of course, many of you who follow Luther would recognize that Luther actually questioned the canonicity of the book of Revelation.
That's right.
Along with James and other books, right? But all of a sudden, you see in the later edition of his works, great praise for the book of Revelation. Now, what accounts for Luther's dramatic change from criticism that this book shouldn't even be in the canon to great praise? Well, Luther seized upon the interpretation of the Antichrist and located that in the papacy. And from Luther forward, every Protestant in the 16th and 17th century was convinced that the papacy and the Pope was the fulfillment of the Antichrist prophecies. So now you have one-to-one correspondent in terms of prophetic fulfillment in the Antichrist, and the Antichrist would be now a prophetic sign for Protestants from that point on. And you specifically see this in Bullinger's commentary on the book of Revelation. Bullinger preached 101 sermons on the book of Revelation. It was a series of sermons dedicated to the refugees of the Protestant nations at time, of course, with Roman Catholicism as the number one enemy. Protestants were oftentimes displaced when Roman Catholic nations would condemn them. And many of them, the refugees, particularly from England, under Mary, Bloody Mary, would flock to Zurich. And Bullinger would be their pastor, really. And Bullinger preached 101 sermons as an attempt, or it was very much in his preface, he was described as an encouragement to these Protestant refugees that Christ would be victorious in the end, no matter what suffering or persecution they were undergoing at the time. And it's interesting to see that Bullinger does something very unique in his interpretation, that this identification of prophecy as having historical fulfillment and one corresponding fulfillment, Bullinger takes that and applies it to the book of Revelation, and then particularly Revelation 20, where he agreed that the 1,000 years referred to in the millennium of Revelation 20 was in fact a literal 1,000 years. But for Bullinger,
instead of, like these Kileans in the past, placing it in the future, he put it in the past. So he argued that were three possible dates, and I can't remember the exact dates, but one of them he would describe as, for instance, the time of Constantine, and then you would count 1,000 years after that. Or the time of Christ and count 1,000 years after that. Or the time of the Apostle Paul and count 1,000 years after that and say that was the millennium. So that would place Bullinger and the church age after that 1,000 period as what period according to the chronology of Revelation 20? The period where Satan was released and allowed to deceive the nations again in anticipation for what? In anticipation for Gog and Magog in the final battle. So Bullinger believed that he lived within that time period where Satan was released. How so? The Antichrist and the rise of the papacy, who claims to be the vicar of Christ on earth, but in fact is the actual manifestation of the most evil power on earth. And as a result of that, Bullinger believes that all he has to anticipate in terms of an apocalyptic timeline is the return of Christ and Gog and Magog and the destruction and fall of Antichrist. And that's the hope to the Protestants. Mm-hmm. You live in this period in which you are anticipating King Jesus will return and defeat now all the forces of that were rallied against Christ. So what Bullinger has done, in my opinion, as he's kicked the door wide open for what I would call a historicist hermeneutic now, that is looking at prophecy and not saying it in terms of symbolic forms like Augustine, but actually looking for one-to-one historic fulfillments.
Very much like a preterist does.
Absolutely. Yeah. But, of course, Bullinger's not a millenarian, nor is he a Kileus. Millenarian being a Latin understanding of Kileism 1,000 years again. Bullinger doesn't place it in the future. He puts it in the past.
Yeah, that's a very peculiar combination of things that we find today.
Now, just to let you know, the influence... Bullinger holds to that position. Francis Junius holds to that position. And you find Bullinger and Junius having a huge impact on the Reformed tradition that even the Geneva Study Bible, which has notes based on both of their interpretations, argues for this in the 16th century.
Jeff, would you agree that both those that put the millennium in the future and those that put it in the past historically have tended to read Revelation through the eyes of current events, that's whatever they may be in their particular time. So there's a hermeneutical similarity, even though there's major difference.
Exactly. And Luther is the one to start it all, kicks it all off. So that every interpreter of Revelation in the Protestant camp in the 16th and 17th century begins with Pope as Antichrist. Mm. Even Calvin, who I would argue is the most consistent Augustinian you will find in the 16th century, but when it comes to the Antichrist, no question, it's the Pope. So even there, he breaks from his Augustinian instincts, if I could describe it that way, and still commits to Luther and says the Pope is Antichrist, absolutely. So no one can get away from that, even those who are trying to be Augustinian, like Calvin himself. I mean, Calvin... You read in the Institutes, he condemns Kileism. Absolutely condemns it. Now, here's the fascinating point here that brings us up to the divines. So by the end of the 16th century, even though you have Bullinger kicking the door open with this historicist hermeneutic, when you look at the three major Protestant traditions by the end of the 16th century, Lutheran, Reformed, Church of England, all three of their major confessional statements, Augsburg Confession, Second Helvetic Confession, if I can point to that, and the Articles of the Church of England, condemn Kileism as heretical. Now, would it be surprising for our listeners to know that by the 17th century, millenarianism, or the 17th century version of Kileism, or if I can put it this way, our modern understanding of premillennialism, was not only acceptable in the 17th century, but in fact was gaining great popularity. So the historical question is, what happened? 16th century condemns it, 17th century acknowledges it, and actually accepts it, and many flock to it, to the point, which brings us up to the divines, I would argue that for many of the divines, they were not only tolerant, but actually held to a millenarian eschatology, an eschatology that viewed the Revelation 20 as a future event, a literal future event. And I can throw names out to you like Thomas Goodwin, Jeremiah Burroughs, Citric Simpson, William Twist, Prolocutor of the Assembly. Now, The historical question is, what accounts for that?
Mm-hmm.
What pushed these individuals now to the point where what was previously condemned is not only acceptable, but is in fact in vogue, if I could describe it that mm-hmm. way. Now, to understand that is to understand the context of the 17th century. By the beginning of the 17th century, as many historians would describe, it is the period of the wars of religion.
Mm-hmm.
Europe and England are divided over religious, theological distinctions. Now, I know the Marxists and the secular historians want to attribute economic and political factors to these wars, and I'm not denying them. No question they were at play. But as John Morrill, professor at Cambridge, has argued, I think there is a huge religious component that we cannot neglect, and it's centered around theology. And for many of them, the wars of religion now center upon still that Reformed Protestant concern of Antichrist against Christ, Roman Catholics, and those who they would see as being, or I should put it this way, capitulating towards Roman Catholicism. And those are the divisions. So that atmosphere of war, uncertainty, of turmoil, of persecution begins to affect the 17th century in some vast, unique ways. If I can point to a particular date, I would point to 1627. In 1627, we begin to see the development of a particular eschatology through the writings of two individuals. Johann Heinrich Alstedt, a Reformed Protestant on the continent, publishes a book, Diatribe de Mille Años, which is later translated into the English with a new title, The Beloved Saints, something like that, in which Alstedt argues for a, what we would describe as premillennial or millenarian eschatology. Now, you have to understand Alstedt now. He has Reformed credentials. He was at the Synod of Dort. He was a Reformed scholastic theologian. And he begins to argue for a future millennium. Why? Alstedt is displaced at least three times as a refugee because of the 30 Years' War in Europe. He sees nothing but violence and warfare all around him. He is convinced that the millennium is not a past event, is not a present event. It must be a future event for the hope of the church. And that context of war affects him to the point where he argues, no, it's got to be a future event. The other individual I would point to is a man named Joseph Meade, who is a Cambridge divine, spent his whole academic career at Christ College in Cambridge training many Puritans under him. And through his own study of the Book of Revelation, he is also convinced by what he calls synchronisms, matching the various visions by their kind of numeric similarities, in which he concludes also that Revelation 20 is a future event. And he has a huge impact on Puritans. I mean, Cambridge was the citadel of Puritan training in the 17th century. So many of them are impacted by his teachings as a student there and go out with the same theology. And he was a very close friend of William Twist, and they would communicate regularly in letters and correspondence. And Twist writes the preface to two of Meade's major works, endorsing his work and endorsing this millenarianism as the proper way to interpret the Book of Revelation. Now, Meade dies in 1638 before all of the turmoil begins to unfold in the English Civil War, so he doesn't see all that. But boy, do his followers latch on to that and say, Charles I and William Laud, moving the Church of England through its practices back to what they would consider crypto-papism, well, he's taking us back to Rome and to Antichrist. And Meade's work then becomes very helpful for them as they began to argue for a Protestant position against Laud and all of his crypto-papists, as they would describe it, mm-hmm. formalities within the church. So what do you find? You have Meade's work, which was originally published in Latin, republished in the 1640s in English. So it's propaganda now coming into play during the English Civil Wars. And all of this has a huge impact on the 17th century when you have leading Protestant scholastic in Europe, Alstedt, and you have a well-respected divine in Cambridge, Joseph Meade, both arguing for millenarianism. And that has a huge impact as the assembly begins to unfold. Robert Bailey, and once the Scottish delegates are invited to come down, Bailey writes in his own journals, there's a bunch of Killiests running around down here. I'm paraphrasing him. He's surprised at this because, of course, he would follow more of an Augustinian view.
Yeah.
But you see that in the Westminster Divines, with Twist, with Burroughs, with Goodwin, millenarians there, premillennialists. Now, the question is, once the standards are written, is it a document that excludes certain eschatological views? Mm. And if so, what was Twist, Goodwin, and Burroughs and these guys up to when they came to the conclusion that this is the new standards for the Church of England?
Yeah.
In particular, and I've seen this in another places in the secondary sources, that have argued that premillennialism or millenarianism is excluded by the standards. Based particularly on passages like when you look at Larger Catechism, questions 86 to 90, that talk about the universal resurrection, the last judgment, and the return of Christ as all being chronological, I should put it this way. I like to describe it as coincident events, but really the way I think the standards describe it is immediate events.
Yeah.
One occurs immediately
you
right after
you can't divide
the
other. Them by thousands of years.
Exactly. Yeah. So that you have universal resurrection, return of Christ, last judgment, all occurring relatively within the same time period.
Yeah, which is the critique of amillennialism. That exactly. Kim Riddleberger's keen on that in his book against what we find in premillennialism.
That's right.
Yeah,
because you've got premillennialists who are divide first and second yes. resurrection, millennium, and all of these things. Well, the fascinating thing is that Joseph Mead provides these millenarian divines with a way of responding that will allow them, in my opinion, in good conscience to sign on to the standards. You see, Mead, borrowing, interesting enough, from Jewish interpretations of Jewish apocalyptic studies, now again, 17th century was not a naive period. They were well aware of what the Jewish rabbis were writing. They were well aware of the current linguistic and critical studies of their period that were much more advanced than I think present day theologians and biblical studies professors give credit to.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And it's amazing to see that Mead gleans from these studies that the Jewish interpretation is prophetically, well, one day equals 1,000 years and 1,000 years
yes,
equals one day.
Exactly.
So that the millennium, which is described as 1,000 years prophetically,
right.
is the day of judgment one day. And so Mead takes the day of judgment and says, well, that's actually referring to the entire 1,000-year period of the millennium. That is the entire day of judgment. So that first and second resurrection that occurs at the beginning and the end, if the day of judgment is a prophetic 1,000 years, well, then it's coincident now. That if Christ returns either at the beginning or the end of that 1,000 years, and it's interesting, Mead doesn't believe Christ will return at the beginning. He believes he'll return at the end.
Mm.
Now you have a prophetic way of describing these events as coincident while at the same time holding to a literal 1,000 years. 1,000 years equals one day. That one day is the day of judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Christ returns in that day at the end of it. And now you can, in good conscience, I would argue, for these millenarians at the assembly, sign on to the Westminster standards, even though the language definitely describes these things as coincident or immediate events.
Really?
Which makes me, personally, as a historian, as one who holds to the standards, much more sympathetic to seeing eschatology in the standards as having allowance for some latitude. The same way, and I know this is a controversial statement, but I'll put it out there. The same way I would argue that the views of creation
right.
ought to have some latitude within the standards.
Let's run with that for a second, because what we find in other branches of broader evangelicalism, if that's what we want to call it, a lot more, they're a lot less tolerant of eschatological views than the Reformed are.
Mm-hmm.
There are good, well-known scholarly Reformed men who hold to all three different forms of eschatology. I guess we could maybe say there are four, but amillennialism, premillennialism, and postmillennialism. And it's a it's surprising to maybe a dispensationalist to actually hear that you know Presbyterians there are people from each of those.
Now
camps.
Let me make just one clarifying
sure.
point. when I'm describing premillennialism and millenarism and Achilleism, it is distinguishable from dispensationalism.
I wanted to ask you that. Yeah. What are those distinguishing features? Yeah. Because my next follow-up question is, how is Achilleism of the assembly different from what we find in the Left Behind books, for instance?
I think the major difference, which I think is at the crux of the issue for dispensationalism, is that no millenarian or Achilleist that I have seen interprets Daniel 9 and the 77s or the 70 weeks in the way that dispensationalists interpret it.
Interesting.
Yeah. It is not, for them, a kind of apocalyptic stopwatch that runs up to the point of Christ and then stops and then picks up again during the last days as a 7-year tribulational period with a rapture. You don't find that at all in the 16th and 17th century. They all see Daniel 9 as a fulfillment, or the fulfillment of Daniel 9 in Christ.
Basically, the fulfillment of the prophecy that the angel came to give.
That's right.
It says, you know, promise the Messiah. And then here he is, Jesus Christ. And and the reversal of that Daniel 9 passage is just stunning.
Yeah.
The fact that the Reformed, and what we take it as being, as referring to the Messiah, gets attributed to Antichrist in the dispensational scheme.
That's right. So that would be, I think, the major decision or major distinction
between,
and I would argue the most serious distinction that would say that ought to question any attempt to link dispensationalism with some kind of 16th or 17th century precursor.
Mm-hmm. Jeff, beyond what you've said already, what would you say to someone who pointed to the postmillennialism of particular Westminster divines over against modern day amillennialist or inaugural millennialist or realized millennialist? And those that would try to say, well, there was no such thing as amillennialism. All you had was post, and maybe some would concede, as you've pointed out historically, pre. How would you answer them if they try to use a historical argument against the modern systematic categories of eschatology?
I would say that's anachronistic, it, meaning that you can find elements both of post and amillennialism in the 17th century. And to paint with such a broad brush to try to make a kind of consistent, what we would consider modern postmillennialism or even a modern amillennialism would be very difficult. For instance, a lot of amillennialists would look at Calvin and try to make him an amillennialist. I'm saying he believes the Pope is Antichrist. That's not entirely consistent with the hermeneutics of what we consider to be present-day amillennialism. Mm-hmm. So you can't fit them into those categories.
We cut that part out of the confession.
That's right. Exactly. And I think Crawford Gribben's work, Crawford Gribben is a professor at Trinity College Dublin who's written on this stuff as well. I think he's very good on this, where he wants to warn us to say, be careful of imposing modern categories back on the 16th and 17th century, because they just don't fit.
Yes.
And you have to take these individuals in the context in which they were working within. And so to say, you know, who is a consistent post-mill or who is a consistent amill, that's hard to do. That's really hard to do in the and I don't think we should do that, because we need to be accurate with our history.
No. Were there any strands of premillennialism you mentioned that look similar to Jewish eschatological views? I would argue that the dispensational views of today seem in many ways, in many respects, to be Jewish from my perspective. Mm. thanks for that one, for that. But to what extent would they be Jewish versus dispensationalism? I mean, would you even agree with that statement?
Well, the dispensationalism, I would say, is definitely not Jewish. In particular, interpretations of Daniel 9, you don't find that in Judaic literature.
I was speaking perhaps more for the view of Messiah as a political ruler who would come and overthrow.
Right. Yeah, you definitely see that in the Jewish literature much more. The it does have a certain impact on what I would consider later millenarians in the 17th century.
Okay.
So you can point to those who are much more politically driven in their agenda, like there was a group described or labeled the Fifth Monarchists, who were very much wanting to usher in the millennial kingdom through political and military means.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have a strand of that more radical view later on in the 17th century, after meat has died, and particularly after the Civil Wars, when now you're talking about individuals who are really pushing for political agendas, mm-hmm. And that's running through the mid-17th century. Yeah.
This may not be a fair question, but you've talked about the political, sociological impact of eschatology on both groups of the divines that would put the millennium in the future and those that would put it in the past. Do you think it's fair for us to say that in some sense, post and premillennialism share an earthly manifestation of the kingdom of God? I mean, this is a pretty obvious question, right. I guess, but in your studies of the Westminster divines, do you see something uniting them?
Yes.
Based on political, earthly manifestations of the kingdom.
Right. And I don't want to be harsh on the 17th century, right. because they lived in a different context. So for them, particularly when they look at their monarchs, monarchs are elected. They are appointed by God to rule in a godly way that enforces and protects true godly religion. Mm-hmm. So the separation of church and state, as we know today, particularly in America,
be absurd
that,
to them.
Yeah, yeah, that's not in their purview of thinking in the 17th century. So that politics and government and even military advancement are considered to be holy works of God. Now, I say that carefully now because, for instance, you can easily document that in the 17th century amongst Puritans, they were keenly aware of what was going on in the 30 Years' War on the continent, particularly when you see the Swedish king Gustavus Adolphus begin to make his way down, and he wins some major victories before he's actually finally killed. But Protestants in England, Puritans, were looking at that and saying he could be the hand of God, and they were actually trying to identify him with certain prophecies in the Revelation as that individual who is defeating the Antichrist as he made his way down and began to accumulate victories over Roman Catholic forces. So yes, there's an earthly element to that in the 17th century. Whether you're a millenarian or even if you're not, you can't get away from it because politics and religion are so intertwined in the 17th century in such a way that you do not see it today, particularly in our Reformed context. And I think Calvin can't even get away from that as well. That even Calvin, he's looking at that also and seeing that. And so that for him, for instance, the endorsement of Michael Servetus's execution, that's political, but that is also religious. There's two aspects of that. And fascinating enough, just to bring this into our discussion here, Michael Servetus is Achilleist. Michael Servetus is an anti-Trinitarian. Now, you think about this. What's going on in Geneva at the time? I would argue that Servetus is arguing. Why is Servetus arguing for anti-Trinitarianism? Because the church has undergone corruption. Mm-hmm. He looks at it in the Roman Catholic Church. So when was there a pure church? Servetus would argue, historically, pre-Nicaea in the early church, before a Trinitarian formulation was established, therefore he's an anti-Trinitarian. The same way that Chiliasm was the most popular eschatology in the early church prior to Nicaea amongst Irenaeus, Lactantius, and Justin Martyr. And one of the interesting discussions that these early Chilias, Irenaeus, Lactantius, and Justin Martyr argued for was soul sleep. That they argued that when a person dies, he goes into subterranean vaults within the earth and lives or exists in a subconscious state until when? Until the first resurrection, you entering into the millennium. Nice. Now, it's fascinating. Nice. Yeah, and it's fascinating to me that in Calvin's Institutes,
Holy
where he...
Sheol, Batman.
That's right. When Calvin criticizes Chiliasm, it's in the section when he deals with bodily resurrection. And Calvin's first book, Psychopanikia, was an argument against soul sleep. I think he connected the dots on Servetus. He knew exactly what Servetus was up to. So that bodily resurrection for him is not connected with soul sleep and not connected with Chiliasm. And so he's got Servetus pegged. He knows exactly what he's up to. And for Calvin, you see it, in my opinion, come together in the way that he structures the Institutes on these various topics. Wow. These various topics, so...
Now, you mentioned the relation of church and state a little bit earlier, the impact that the cultural and social and political context had upon the eschatological views of the divine. Do you see any modern parallels with our socio-political structure in the United States, perhaps impacting eschatological views?
I think so. I think there is no question, particularly with dispensationalism, that the endorsement and support for Israel can be traced back to evangelical popularity mm-hmm. with a dispensationalist position. I think if you polled evangelicals today, dispensationalism is, whether you're talking about classical or progressive dispensationalism, the most popular eschatology out there.
Oh, clear. Sure. Even if it hasn't been explicitly taught, it's been kind of learned by osmosis.
Even in Presbyterian circles.
That's right.
Yeah.
It's had its impact.
And I think it's had a huge impact on American culture, from foreign policy with Israel.
Absolutely.
All the way down to, you know, how we view issues of church and state and how we view the culture. Mm-hmm. And I think very much eschatology still has a significant role in what we're seeing today. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Jeff, is your book published?
It is.
Who publishes it?
I have to be honest to all the listeners out there, it's not something that's easily accessible.
Or affordable.
Yeah, it's published by Springer, which was a Dutch and now German press, academic press, and it's pretty pricey.
And what is the title of it?
It's Heaven Upon Earth, The Legacy of Joseph Meade.
Okay.
And I used Meade as the launching pad into all of this because he was so influential here. And I explore both the impact in the Dutch Reformed tradition as well as England, of course, and then also in the colonies in New England at the time.
Mm-hmm. And I think Lane was going to ask a question.
I was just simply going to say, if our measure is truly eschatological, it's something that should be
nice.
I won't encourage anyone to, as good stewards of the money God's given them, to attempt to buy it.
Mark,
I'll go on a limb and just do that.
My hope actually is because the dissertation was written to appease an academic audience. I mean, that's what it was for British historians or historians of early modern Britain. I'm hoping at some point to be able to take some of those ideas, historical ideas and concepts, and put them into a form that I think would better serve seminary students, the church, those who are interested in this topic, that don't want to necessarily weed through, you know, 17th century early modern mm-hmm. British historiography to get to some of these topics. So, yeah.
If we fast forward just a couple hundred years, I know, Jeff, you and I had mentioned and talked about Jonathan Edwards' eschatological views and how he was very keen on keeping track of the signs of the times in current events. What can we learn from him, and what ought we to stay away from, I suppose, in the eschatological views and practice of Jonathan Edwards?
I've got a piece. This is like what I said I would never do, so I won't mention it, actually. But I've looked into this in terms of Jonathan Edwards' eschatology, and I am convinced, and Jeff might disagree with me on this, but I am convinced that if I were to describe Edwards' eschatology, I would describe him historically as a modified millenarian. Now, I say that in terms of a historical analysis, because though Edwards is, strictly speaking, a post-millennialist, meaning that he believes that the return of Christ would come at the end of the millennium, the way he describes the nature and the character of the millennium and the sources that he uses historically, they're all millenarian. Now, he has every opportunity. Edwards is a learned man. He has every opportunity to consult the Augustinian sources of his time and of the tradition previous to him. Mm-hmm. He does not. Mm-hmm. And I've done this and traced his sources, and his sources are all within the millenarian tradition of England. So to me, there is this millenarian strand that gets modified with Edwards. Nevertheless, he's dependent on that tradition and not on an Augustinian symbolic mm-hmm. spiritual tradition, in my opinion.
Now, in my reading of Edwards, the preterist view becomes increasingly important. He's always referring to the destruction of Jerusalem mm-hmm. throughout his sermons and his writings.
Yes.
And that seems to play into the divines a lot. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm wondering, in your study of all them, how much is that driving things, or is that a product of their views politically and reading current events? Are they forced to read things In a more full preterist type. I don't know if I'm wording that correctly.
Yeah, I wouldn't describe them as full preterists. Definitely they are being careful to distinguish what has been fulfilled and what is not, and doing so in very specific ways. Edwards does the same. To me, that is part of the hermeneutic that millenarians are using. Not identical to all of, they're not all the same. It's not uniform through. But there's a common hermeneutical method functioning there that lends to historical fulfillments of prophetic events like the destruction of Jerusalem as well. And Edwards is in that tradition. There's no question in my mind. Edwards is in that tradition. And so to describe Edwards, as some historians have done, some theologians have done, as the first post-millennialist, that all depends on how you define post-millennialism and how you view that in relationship to a millenarian tradition.
Thank you.
Jeff, since you didn't mention it, I will. You have a chapter in the Gaffin Festschrift, Resurrection and Eschatology, that deals with this topic. And Camden, is, if you remember, when we talked about Edwards' eschatology, I said, one, I was not an expert in this area. And two, we did have a subsequent conversation where I mentioned Jeff's article, and it's exactly right. I think to call him a post-millennial is anachronistic.
Yeah. I would distinguish Edwards, just historically, from the post-millennialism that you would find in, for instance, Old Princeton, Lorraine Bettner's views, and others. That is a very different stripe of post-millennialism then I would argue that Edwards is in. Yeah.
Now, where would Bonson fall in this, in his stripe of theonomic postmillennialism? Is it similar? Yeah. Are there some striking differences at all?
I think his postmillennialism proper is probably closer to the old Princetonians.
Okay.
But the theonomic aspect, in my opinion, has similarities. I know this is like for a whole nother topic that we could go into. Has similar hermeneutical principles with dispensationalism, and I know that I know that's opening up a can of worms right now.
That's fine.
We might not want to go down. And that's where I would ask Dr. Lane Tipton to come back and join us on that topic if we were to go there.
Absolutely. Yeah. Speaking of amillennialism, if we want to move over into that realm, one thing you've kept talking about is the reading of Revelation 20 as an earthly millennial period in which Christ will return and reign as a king physically on the earth. If we read Revelation straight through chronologically and read chapter 19 before chapter 20, you end up with some form of premillennialism. Mm-hmm. When did the hermeneutic arise that yields an amillennial view? Particularly asking, traditionally, the amillennialists read Revelation as a series of recapitulations. That particular hermeneutic or reading of that apocalyptic literature is interesting to me. When did that come into play?
Right. The recapitulation goes way back to Augustine. Augustine and Primasius, another early figure who writes on this, and runs through even to Bede and others in the medieval period. That is a common view of looking at the book of Revelation and seeing it as multiple visions, particularly seven visions,
right,
and looking at that. And it's fascinating to see. Now, here's another distinction. The millenarians of the 17th century do not read Revelation as a strict chronology from chapter 1 all the way through to the end. They don't either. Mead doesn't do that. Mead doesn't do that. He sees that as separate visions running through. He divides it into two, actually.
Really?
Yeah. So recapitulation is something very common with
even outside amillennialism.
That's right. Okay. Outside amillennialism within the interpretation. So that, I would argue, in terms of strict chronological reading of Revelation, is another dispensational uniqueness, unique position. Yeah.
Does he break anywhere? Where does he break his views? Because even the dispensationalists will have to, in some sense, read Revelation out of out of written order, because chapter 11 and 12 are out of order in the dispensationalist scheme. Chapter 11 being the appearance of the two witnesses. Chapter 12 referring to the birth of Christ.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
And so what's going on there?
Yeah, so there's got to be some dischronology going on. For
sure.
Everyone. Yeah. But for millenarians in the 17th century, it breaks up more than once. And there are a number of places where you have visions that are describing the same event from different perspectives, which we would argue is very similar to our amillennial hermeneutic that's going on.
Okay.
So again, that's another point that's a good point to bring up, that you see a distinction between dispensationalists of the 21st century variety,
yes,
and the millenarians of the 17th century.
Now, is the recapitulation theme something common to Jewish apocalyptic literature?
Not that I'm aware of, and I haven't looked at that in detail enough, because of course Revelation's not Jewish literature.
No.
Yeah.
But,
so recapitulation,
but still, yes.
Yeah, is very unique to Revelation in the category of apocalyptic or prophetic literature.
Sure.
In that sense. But you do see it in other places as well. It is a genre.
Yes.
A category within
of that
apocalyptic
time period.
Literature. Yeah,
yes.
Within apocalyptic literature. Yeah.
Okay.
Which I think, you know, so here we see an example in which genre distinctions are very informative for us here and help us understand our exegesis of particular texts.
So my question there would be then, and this is a question perhaps that cannot be answered authoritatively by any of us, but maybe, how would a Jew have read Revelation when it was written?
That's a really interesting question. I'm not sure that they would make any sense of it.
Okay.
I think obviously they would see probably genre similarities with the Book of Daniel and other mm-hmm. prophetic passages. But then there are unique things there that when you look at, you can see they're extending beyond the Old Testament prophetic genre.
Yeah.
And you cannot make sense of those things outside of the life, death, resurrection of Jesus
right.
Christ.
Clearly.
Yeah. So in one sense, they would look at it and say, oh, you know, I can see similarities yeah. in terms of genre with what I read in Daniel or Ezekiel, but then it's describing
but then it makes no sense. It's right.
That is beyond what Daniel and Ezekiel
yeah.
are describing. And I think there you would see now, for at least a Jewish reader, possibly, and again, you know, this is clearly conjecture here on,
sure.
this, on my part, to say, yeah, there's something unique here. There's something going on here that is moving forward,
mm-hmm.
if I could put it that way. But yeah, I'm speculating.
That's fine. Yeah. One thing you mentioned, I believe, before we actually started recording is the Mark of the Beast.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's very interesting to me, something a feature that is common in Revelation. How did the divines view, or what did they see as the mark of the beast versus what we might expect to be the mark of the beast?
All roads lead to Antichrist and to the papacy.
The papacy.
That's right, yeah.
That's right.
So the mark of the beast, numerically, has all kinds of different mathematical formulations that they would use, but it all leads back in some way to the Pope. Yeah.
But that's almost not a fair question, because I mean there's no unified way that we understand
right, yeah.
the mark of the beast
yeah.
today
yeah.
either.
Yeah.
And a question, and this is more of a biblical studies question, but I do believe the systematics and church historians can also tread those waters at times. My question being the relationship between what John is getting at with the mark of the beast. You know, the sign on the four on your hand and your forehead, and the parallels to Deuteronomy 6, which is the, you know, bind the word of God to your hand and the frontlets on your forehead, seeing that Jews misunderstood that at times to mean literally bind a scroll to your hand and to your forehead. And in the same way, what we find in some versions of common modern eschatology is that, you know, we might have a computer chip or a barcode tattooed onto our hand or our forehead, which seems to me to be the same error that many Jews made in back in Deuteronomy 6. So my question being, you know, what's going on there between Deuteronomy 6 and then what John's getting at with the mark of the beast? And then the differences between the understanding of that between modern day and the Westminster Seminary.
Well, Dr. Tipton teaches the eschatology class at Westminster, so I'm going to throw this one over to him.
That's a good question. I think that what comes into view when you think of a phylactery, when you
yes.
think of that which is impressed upon the mind and that which controls the hands, is simply the way that you think in terms of soteriology. What do you find, soteriologically speaking, in the church? Will you find a replication of the life and the righteousness and the holiness of Christ? Christ dwells in the hearts and the minds of his people. And as such, what they think and what they do reveals something of the mind and the life of Christ. That's why Paul can say, Christ is raised to the right hand of the Father in heavenly places. You are raised with Christ. Live as befits your status. And so you offer your body to Christ as a living sacrifice. All that you think and do is a revelation of the work of God in Christ in the church. What you find in terms of the mark of the beast is a thoroughgoing replication of the mind of Antichrist. Mm. You find it stamped upon the heart and the mind and the hands of those who follow Antichrist. And so if we hearken back to the Augustinian philosophy of history to which Dr. Jew alluded earlier, it begins in Genesis 3 at the time point of the fall. And you find those who worship and serve the Creator, who love the Redeemer. You find those who are going to follow the seed of the woman, which is Christ, those who will follow the seed of the serpent, which is Antichrist. And in terms of that sort of language, you find the most basic antithesis in the history of redemption, which is rooted in the fall and focused on the death and resurrection of Christ as Messiah. And you see in that then something that which is typical in the book of Revelation, that underscores or unveils for us the most basic antithesis in human history. And a popular way to put it is that Satan is in the market of creating counterfeits, right. Yeah. Of replicating his person, work, and kingdom in the sons of disobedience.
That's something that Dr. Poitras is very keen on addressing in the book of Revelation, the fact that you have a counterfeit trinity, even. Nick, go ahead.
I've wondered often about the language of seal in the Greek, the same word that's used in Revelation. The seal that God seals his servants with harkens back to the language of baptism and what that symbolizes and how Christians are sealed with the seal of God, even the Holy Spirit, and how Satan comes to counterfeit that with the mark of the beast, the seal of the beast. Those words are used interchangeably. So what Lane is saying, kind of building on that, that there's almost a counterfeit covenant between Satan and the world.
There exactly is.
So. Yeah.
Is there anything that you find particularly insightful in exegeting Daniel 9 that helps us navigate the problems associated with the dispensational exegesis of that text?
I am convinced that the best exegesis that I've seen of Daniel 9 is Meredith Klein's article on the 70 weeks. I think that that strikes at the very heart of what dispensationalist interpreters are arguing for in such a way that allows us to bring to bear our biblical theological as well as our Reformed distinctions on that passage as being fulfilled in Christ, and recognizing then the nature of Old Testament prophecy as it's being interpreted from the perspective of Christ. Now, and we can go into detail on that, but I would recommend our listeners to look at that article and how he understands the 70 weeks in its sabbatical pattern and how that relates then to what is fulfilled in Christ and the Sabbath rest that Christ brings through his work in his life, death, and resurrection. And we can go into more detail on that.
What are some books other than your own and the ones that you've already mentioned which we can go and read about these eschatological views of the divine, divines, perhaps other than primary sources?
Right. I think Crawford Griffin's work is very good. He's got a book that's been now published in its second edition on the Puritan millennium. I think that's a really helpful book. An older study that kind of introduces some of these discussions is Peter Toon's work, T-O-O-N. And in terms of more modern systematic discussions, I think Kim Riddlebauger's latest book is very good on amillennialism.
I really enjoyed that. Yeah. That was my conversion to amillennialism. Right.
And then some of the more scholarly exegetical works, Fowler White and Meredith Klein's work on Revelation 20, articles on Revelation 20, is article on Daniel 9 that I've mentioned. I think all of those are very helpful works. I'd also recommend, in terms of some of the pastors out there who are looking through commentaries, Greg Beale's commentary on the book of Revelation, and maybe on a more popular level or educated lay level, Dennis Johnson has a commentary on Revelation, as well as Vern Poitras's work on Revelation.
I have a question about the more literal-ish views of, like, an Anthony Hookema and his views on amillennialism. You have anything, any comments on that?
Yeah, I mean, you look at amillennialism, and then, you know, talking to Dr. Gaffin about this at one point, you do see different distinctions amongst amillennialists as well.
Yeah.
You know, you'll see some who are more optimistic, some who are more pessimistic. There's all kinds of strands in there. And I think that will come down to various nuances in terms of particular passages and how we interpret that.
Yeah. Okay.
Jeff, I think our listeners would want to know, what position do you adhere to, and are you coming out with any books in the near future or the far future that might deal with eschatology, biblical eschatology?
Well, in the words of my former church history professor, Bob Godfrey, I'm just a historian. I just tell you what the details are in terms of what. No, I'm just kidding. No, definitely, I am much more persuaded and convinced of the amillennial position. And I'm hoping to produce something on that, particularly for a more educated lay version of eschatology, and then as well as some historical perspectives as well.
We want to thank everybody for joining us. We had a really good time discussing these things. I hope our listeners will really benefit from this discussion. We appreciate your scholarly work. You can visit us at castlechurch.org. You can get the rest of our programs, everything else that we do. You can subscribe to our podcast feeds and also view today's bibliography, which is a very rich one. And you're definitely going to want to go and read many of those books that were mentioned. But until then, you can get a hold of us at castlechurch.org/contact. And of course, we're eager to get your feedback and to interact with you as well. We'd like to thank everyone for listening, and we look forward to having you back next time on Christ the Center.